There we go. We're working more and more on our identification with our divine consciousness. And not throwing away our small self, but relegating it to its proper place. It's not in charge. To pick up where we left off on page 70. Now, high will or true will must be understood. And we don't understand that just with our mind. This is not a lesson in intellect. It's more a lesson in connecting with the heart, whatever that means for you. Nobody is asking you to forget anything. It's useful to remember that the rattlesnake is poisonous and avoid stepping on it. But there's no need to be frightened at what may occur, what may occur. Stress that. Because we don't know what's going to occur. What may occur when you leave the house and walk around the corner? The realization of the monad, in fact, the oneness, claims a path for you, defines a path for you in accordance with high will. And what it hints at there is something that we're probably familiar with in a number of other readings, and that is that, when we incarnated or came here on planet Earth, we decided on a particular blueprint or our identification that we were going to use, lessons that we were here to learn. And so what I've come up with, and it's probably an oversimplification, is whatever shows up is something that I already pre-programmed to learn from, whether that's a relationship, whether that's something internally for me, or some external kind of situation. Instead of asking the question why, because the question why is already answered. Why is this here? Why is it here? Because I chose it to be here. But the real question is, what am I supposed to do with it? How do I heal it? How do I change it? How do I let it go? How do I heal it? Now, high will or true will must be understood. Warning. Divine will is not a separate idea from self. The self that knows who it is, operating in accord with its truth or in high truth that expresses beyond memory or edict born through collective reasoning. Okay, so that gets a little bit wordy. I think. There is an aspect of you that expresses beyond memory. Beyond the small self. We're not throwing that away, but we're saying it only gives you, only gives us a limited point of view of what the truth is about. And I can probably know that I am in limited viewpoint of who I am or what I am or the situation I find myself in. When I find myself fearful, angry, frustrated, a higher self, as powerful as it is still going to be gentle. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to get caught up sometimes, especially in the process of grieving. But we can begin to know the difference between higher consciousness and lower consciousness. Course in Miracles put it very simply: is it love or is it fear? Or the one that I like to use an awful lot, does it open my heart or does it close my heart? Not a right or wrong, just one's limited, one's unlimited. Which space am I choosing to be in? Which space am I choosing to learn from? The will that you have known, personal will if you wish, is of course integrated here. It is always the braiding of the will, the true will, and the will of the personality structure in a true aligned state that expresses divine will and will lead you on a course, direct your path in perfect ways. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I don't know the road ahead of me. That's that wonderful prayer from Thomas Merton. Echoes the same sentiment, I believe. The will that you have known, the personal will, if you wish, is of course integrated here. It's taken into account. It is always the braiding of the will. When you braid something, you're kind of tying it together. Not in a knot, but in an interlocking space, like a braid.
Gary,
yes.
So I think there's a second question that goes along with, is it love or is it fear? Or maybe we just ask that at two different times. One is, someone is relating to us. There's a situation going on. And what am I feeling? Am I feeling love or fear? And then the second question is, how do I respond? Do I respond in love or do I respond in fear? Does that make sense?
What was the first part again, John?
The first part is, what am I feeling? What am I experiencing within myself? Because so often I find that I may be responding unconsciously, and I'm responding out of fear or out of a desire that things be as different way than they currently are. I don't want to go do that. I don't want to have to be involved in this. But then the next question is, well, how do I respond? Do I respond out of love? Do I respond out of fear? Because if I'm feeling fear, I often just respond out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can catch myself, I can choose to act lovingly. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What comes to my mind, John, is that in my interaction with other human beings, that the primary spiritual process that I'm involved with is being as present as I possibly can to and with this other person. However that expresses itself. Sometimes it might express itself in silence. I'm not sure whether that answers your question or not.
No, I think it does. I think that does. Being present is another way of expressing the same idea.
Okay. What I go back to sometimes, the psychologist Carl Rogers once said that the moment of therapeutic healing happens when I am completely present to the person I'm working with. I'm not thinking about what's next. I'm not thinking about how to solve a problem. I'm not thinking about the next question to ask. I am just fully and completely present to this other human being. And he said, in that space, in that energy, right, is where the healing happens. Doesn't happen because I have a degree on my wall. Doesn't happen because I think I know the answer. Doesn't happen because I know more than you do. Doesn't happen. It happens when I am fully and completely present to you as another being. There have probably been some teachers in your life, formal teachers or informal teachers, that you probably remember fondly, but you might not remember too much about what they taught you in the subject matter. But what you do remember, what you do recall, what you do connect with is that they were present to you. They looked at you, they saw you, they were with you as another human being, even though you might have been 10 years younger. And it's that sense of presence that we bring to any encounter that we enter into. And it is our presence that can be a choice. How can I be? That might be my question. How can I be fully present to this other being? Sometimes it might be by saying something, sometimes it might be just by not saying anything at all.
Yes, and I think it's the question I keep asking myself is how do I respond in love versus this fear that I'm experiencing?
Well, I think the answer to that is pretty much the same. I respond in love by being completely present to this other being and not be overly concerned about whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I'm saying the right thing or doing the right thing. Just being here with, now I might call for words, it might not.
Well, in some cases, it's what do they need? Why are they behaving this way? Or why are we in this even this conversation? What's going on here? What do they need? And that may be part of it.
Okay, and that might be my question. What does this other person need from me? And sometimes I might need to ask that out loud.
Sometimes the response is, I don't need anything from you.
Sometimes it is, you're right. And we have to live with that. The will that you have known, personal will, if you wish, is of course integrated here. It's part of the process. But it's when I interact with another human being, it's not about me getting my needs met. That's where the small self kind of walks in and kind of screws things up a little bit. Not about me at all, about the other person. It is always the braiding of the will, the true will, and the will of the personality structure in a true aligned state of expression, divine will. And it will lead you on a course, direct your path in perfect ways, in ways you have already defined for yourself, in ways that you have already set in motion. Not only do we create our own reality, but we have created the pathway that we are here to follow on this particular incarnation. We've decided already on the lessons we have come here to learn. I remember a good friend of mine, Molly, actually her name was Molly Malone. She lived up in Indianapolis. We worked together for a while. I remember one time I was visiting her and playing around with her cats. And she was in the midst of a struggle of something, some sort. Can't remember exactly what it was, but she would walk up and down the hallway in the living room, almost wearing a hole in the closet, in the carpet, saying to herself, "What's the lesson here? What's the?" And she would not. She would. It would be, "I will not let you go until you bless me. All right? I want to know what the lesson is, and then I'll stop asking." But she would be determined. Whatever was going on, as difficult as it might be, as crazy as it might seem, what am I supposed to learn from this? I never forgot that because that was a great little exercise of knowing and doing what you really needed to do to get through whatever it was you're trying to get through. What's the lesson here? Not why is this happening to me, which is what my small self by itself is going to ask. But the lesson here, not only why did I create this, but what did I create here? And what is the lesson I created here to learn? And as Jim reminded us a couple of weeks ago, everybody else is going through that same process themselves. They might not be doing it consciously, but they still are. And so it's not, again, when I interact with another human being who's in that stuck place, not about me at all, about where they're coming from. And I can bless that path as best I possibly can. Thing.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah.
Wow. So, as you were speaking, what came through me is that the small self or the ego self of mine can be just so dismissive of, what is it, one? Why? What is it for me to learn? Because because my higher self is recognizing now that this entire incarnation of mine encounters, experiences, everything, there is lessons for me to learn. But that lower self is kind of like, we kind of dismiss it and not even give it the time of day. It's almost like the lower self is like is in a constant state of distraction and being unaware. And then the other thing is that I say to myself, I mean, I'm thinking is that can I be willing to seek to understanding that which is in front of me, that person or that situation, as opposed to here's a lower self, please understand me. If that makes
Yeah, and we have to be aware enough to be able to ask that question, right? That's kind of the tricky part. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
Okay. The divine will lead you on a course, direct your path in perfect ways. Again, my Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I don't know the road ahead of me. But I do know that I will be guided. I do know that I am being guided. What is a perfect way, Paul asks? It sounds lovely, but what does it mean? A perfect way for you, Paul, would be a way where the realization of self is gained in accord with what you can hold in alignment in perfect ways. In other words, if I accept the perfection of what's going on right now and I'm open to learning from it. Remember Ram Dass was talking one time about he was with his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and they were standing or sitting on a hillside in India, looking down at this rather poor village down below. And his guru looked at Ram Dass and said, "Ram Dass, can't you see it's all perfect?" He said, "Perfect? It's not. Those people down there are hungry. They're starving. They need to be educated. They need this, they need that." And he sort of patted him on the head and said, "Yes, Ram Dass, go down there and help them." So, in other words, the paradox of perfection is that it's perfect for you at this particular moment, but there's also work to be done. It's perfect, and there's work to be done. In the Buddhist realm, chop wood and carry water. It's perfect, but there's work to be done.
Is there ever enough perfection and being enough in perfection, or is there always work to be done?
It's a good question. When I look at perfection, I'm also getting a sense of there's nothing there to push against, or there's nothing pushing on me. But that doesn't mean that I'm not working or not loving. I have. Let's say in my process of becoming who I truly am as a divine being, that I am going to be continually confronted with the idea or the sense of opening my heart to unconditional love. And I don't think that ever ends. But there will come a time, I believe, even in this lifetime, there will come a time when I will be in the presence or the activity of unconditional love without necessarily being reminded of it. I just am. I believe Jesus reached that state of enlightenment where how did he put it? Before Abraham came to be, I am. And really pissed off the Pharisees. They really didn't like that one at all. But what he was saying, part of what he was saying was, I don't have to be perfectly present to you, but I am perfectly present to you. I don't have to get pushed into that realm. It just radiates from me because of my sense of who I truly am at this moment. I am unconditional love. And then you could ask yourself the question, well, how much is enough unconditional love? And of course, the answer to that is there's never an end point to that. So the lower self is always kind of pushing, pushing, pushing. The higher self is, but in a paradoxical way, I am, and I am continuing to grow at the same time. That's my understanding of it at this point. I am. And I'm still growing at the same time.
Jerry?
Yeah.
Just a quick comment. I in my experience, there are many times where the perfect can be the enemy of the good. There are a lot of times where people are constantly unhappy with very good things because they are not perfect. And in my experience, a lot of the lower self standards for perfection end up making one unhappy when one shouldn't necessarily be unhappy. And the paradox is that the upper room is already kind of perfect. It's just getting there and staying in that state. So there's this challenge of the standard of perfections that we hold are always shifting and changing on a worldly level. But on the higher level, I think they're more permanent.
That's a great distinction to be able to make.
Jerry?
Yeah.
What Rob just said, wouldn't that also relate back to us not truly accepting within us the idea of impermanence? Because, the grasping for something to make us happy, or what might look perfect, but we're still not happy because we're actually looking for all the outer things to make us happy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so temporary. It's like a fleeting thing. Something happens and it's so exhilarating, and then it goes.
It's gone. Right. It doesn't
one
last.
Of one of my Reverend Moore, who Jim knows I've talked about, said it was important. This is where balance in your, to work for balance in your life is so important. Not too high, not too low. That middle road. If you go too high in your exhilaration of happiness, of excitement or whatever, the drop is going to be harder. And if you go too low, it's harder to get up a bit. So keeping in that middle road of balance and the concept of truly, I mean, I'm just really working on this and feeling it more and more that there just is nothing in the material. There can be a joyous moment, but it's not the root of what makes us happy.
Yeah. The great way is not difficult for those who have no opinions.
Exactly.
When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make one distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. That's a Zen Buddhist poem called the Sin Sin Ming.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite pieces of spiritual literature. It also goes on to say, even to become attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. Because you're just creating another attachment.
Hey, Jerry.
Yes, Jim.
So thank you for sharing with me your book. What I got from it, and I'm looking at it right now, and I said it to myself, it just doesn't matter. My gosh, Jerry, that right there sums it all. It just doesn't matter.
What Jim is referring to is there was an older movie, Bill Murray movie called Meatballs, where he was a counselor at a summer camp. And there was the camp that he was in the counselor with were sort of lower middle class kids, blue collar kids. And on the other side of the lake was the rich kids camp. And they all had uniforms and masseuses and all kinds of nice stuff. And they had all the money. And every year they would have an Olympics, 2-day Olympics between the kids on either side of the lake. And of course the kids from the lower middle class kids would always get creamed because they never had the right equipment. They never had the good stuff. So it happened one summer, same thing happened the first day they got creamed. Bill Murray's driving the bus back home, back to the summer camp for the blue collar kids. And he goes through this whole big harangue, almost like a minister, about this, about who cares whether they have uniforms or not? Who cares if they have a masseuse? Blah, 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 blah. And he said, you know what? It just doesn't matter. And he started pounding on the steering wheel and said, it just doesn't matter. And the kids picked it up. It just doesn't matter. And they brought it into the mess hall and they started pounding on the table. It just doesn't matter. Just doesn't matter. And it was a marvelously freeing moment because I'm letting go of all of my expectations. I'm letting go of all of the stall of the judgments on myself or anybody else. And it doesn't matter. Now, on another level, of course, it does matter. But most of the time, majority of times, what I am so concerned with, like Mark Twain said, I'm an old man, I have many problems, but most of them never happened. That's why it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because it doesn't exist. Right? Probably never did exist. It only existed up here someplace. It just doesn't matter. Tremendously freeing.
Jerry, I have a different image in my head. I appreciate those two examples, but I'm thinking about an experience I had years and years ago. I went on something called the Emmaus Walk. It was a 3-day workshop, non-denominational, and all Christ-centered. When Sunday came, one of the big things they kept talking about was, right now you're on a mountaintop. You are really high. You just love all this stuff. You know what this is all about. Tomorrow, you have to go down the mountain. Tomorrow, you have to go down into the valley. Tomorrow, you have to actually try to apply these lessons that you've learned. And lately, I've been rereading some of the New Testament, and I think Jesus, a number of times, talks to his disciples and says, here's what's coming. Here's what I expect you to do. Here, this is the hard part. Being with me is fun. Being with me is interesting. But all these miracles are happening. But when I'm gone, you have to go do this. You have to do what I did. You have to do what I do. Thanks.
Okay. And now the work begins. It is a realization as can be manifested and maintained. It's not a rush to higher state of experience or consciousness. Too many of you these days mistake a higher experience for a higher alignment. Kind of what John was talking about, the high of a workshop or a talk or something like that that really lifts us up. But that's kind of like an emotional balloon, right? It isn't really true. It's tying in with emotions. Jesus was very careful not to talk about feelings too much because his teaching was not about feelings. His teaching was about experience and being open to that experience. To many of you these days, mistake a higher experience for a higher alignment. You can go out and watch the fireworks. But when they are not there, when they're not going off, all you have is the memory of them. To achieve a higher state through any means must support you in an awareness of what the experience was. But unless that experience is utilized in a high way, it has been something else, something less than the fireworks display. It's been an experience, fleeting perhaps, that did not leave a thumbprint that can be responded to and realized through our daily lives. So leaving us kind of where John said, now the work begins. I can't rest on the past experience. However, I have one objection to that. This is just my own personal stuff, is that I think that experience can be something that exists in the memory, which is just something that's fleeting, is just an idea. It's kind of like looking at a family picture album. But there are other experiences that are a lot that remain alive within us that we can draw power from. And I believe that's true for many, many spiritual experiences that we've had in our lives. They're not just a memory, not just an idea, not just something that happened a couple of years ago. They are also part of our reality right now. And I think for me anyway, that's tremendously important to realize that I'm not just talking about something that happened in the past that was nice, good, but now it's back to work. Now it's back to the real world, we used to say at the end of retreat.
Well, it's kind of like being in a group right now and studying that book, being in this energy, and when I go up there, I can tap into what that energy was to help me in a moment.
Definitely. Definitely.
But I've got to put into action what it is we're studying.
Yes, definitely. It's both of those things. It's being able to tap into that energy, right? And it's also doing something to be able to maintain that level of energy. And it's not an emotional choice we make. When we make a choice between love and fear, it's not an emotion. When I ask myself, does it open my heart or does it close my heart? It's not in an emotional way. It's a choice we make. I choose to be present to you, or I choose not to be present to you. If I choose not to be present, I might be saying to myself, "Well, I got my stuff. You think you got problems? Listen to mine." And I can recognize that's my small self talking, but it's still easy to get caught up in that. See, we're talking about something that exists in a rather a paradoxical place. It's predictable in some ways it's not. It's living out of higher consciousness, but it's also living out of consciousness that continues to grow and change and evolve. It's not just one, it's not one or the other, it's both. How do I be kind and gentle and compassionate to other people? By being loving and kind and compassionate towards myself. And that doesn't eliminate one or the other. They're both there. They're both part of the process. But it's a great example to think of what happens when I walk out of here and somebody's sitting in my pew. Somebody's sitting in the spot that I usually go to. How do I react? How do I respond? Internally, externally. That's the challenge. How do I keep that? How do I take that and how do I keep that with me? And the answer might be different in different situations.
Hey, Jerry.
Yes, Jim.
Just a quick note. I love what you just said. So the emotional void of that. So if Jim isn't asking, how can I take this that I've just in this container, now take it into my life and apply it, like you, what you said, into the quote unquote the real world? There's no transformation. It's just, you know, it was just like, okay, I had a good meal. It was good, but then there's nothing more of that. It's limited, if that makes any sense.
The way the book puts it is, to achieve a higher state through any means must support you in an awareness of what that experience was. In other words, the reality of that experience. Transfiguration, when Jesus took Peter, James, and John up to the mountaintop and changed himself into what he truly looks like, this divine being. His face shone like the sun. His garments were white as snow. And then he said to them, well, he didn't say it, he might not have said it out loud. He said, okay, now I've shown you the truth of who you are. And now it's up to you to go down from the mountain and prove to yourselves that's who you are. I have shown you the truth. I've shown you the truth of who you are. And now it's up to you to discover the ways and the means of being able to be that truth of who you are. No matter what you might be feeling, no matter what the external parts of external pieces that are going on might be. To achieve a higher state through any means must support you in an awareness of what that experience was. The energy of that experience exists within you. But unless that experience is utilized in a high way, in other words, it's not just there to make you feel good. It's not just there to make you comfortable. It has been something less than the fireworks display. It has been an experience, fleeting perhaps, that did not leave a thumbprint that can be responded to and realized through your daily lives. And yet, I believe it can be. I think they go on and answer that in the next paragraph. But let's suppose we've all experienced, I think we've all experienced being loved. And there might be specific instances where the process or the experience of being loved is partly a memory. And also when you remember it, you can experience it internally inside of you again, just like you did before. It's both. It's both an experience in the past, a memory, and it's a present truth today, right now. We're going to need to close up this morning. Somebody at the front door, I think. Okay, I'm going to ask you to get comfortable in your spot. And close your eyes if you like. It feels as if today's learning is sort of open-ended. That we've not wrapped everything up in a nice, neat little package. That the challenge of acting from the truth of who you are is still very much present. And knowing that when we push the button to end this particular class, to walk out the door, the challenge doesn't disappear, but it's almost automatic for most of us to go into lower consciousness mode when we leave a place or a situation like this. So I'm suggesting for me, as well as for you, that every once in a while today, you just sort of remind yourself, if you don't do this practice already, you remind yourself, I am a divine being, I am a unique expression of divine consciousness. I am a unique expression of divine consciousness. And nothing, absolutely nothing, can change that. It can grow, it can evolve, but it's never going to leave. And close your eyes and breathe. Allow yourself to be uncluttered, free. Not worried about, oh, I'm going to have to remember to do this. I'm going to have to remember to do that. Stop. You will remember. You can remember. You can experience aspects of love that you already have experienced. They are always with you. Behold, I am with you all days, even to the end of the world, he said. There is no end to my love. There is no end to your receptivity of love and grace and healing. And one of the best and easiest ways of reminding ourselves of that is through gratitude. Gratitude is an experience that is alive within each one of us, much more than a memory, much more than an idea, much more than a feeling. So with a sense of love and grace and gratitude, take another deep breath. Stretch a bit. Open your eyes when you're ready. Thank you for sharing your divinity with one another.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Have a great week, guys.
Thanks, Jerry.
Jerry.
You're welcome, guys. I love you. See ya.